Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Friday, July 30, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today, Blahnik guilty of fatally stabbing Bagley. This story by Trish Mahaffey. Jury deliberations that appeared headed for a mistrial instead brought emotions Thursday of relief, exhaustion, and happy to the father of Chris Bagley after he heard the guilty verdict for his son's killer, Drew Blahnik. The Bagley family members cried and shared hugs after the verdict was read and the jury was dismissed from Linn County District Court. The anxiety the family said they had over the last 2 weeks of the murder trial went away as soon as they heard the word guilty. The jury deliberated for nearly 3 days before finding Blahnik, originally charged with first-degree murder, guilty of the lesser charge of second-degree murder in the 2018 killing. Jurors also found him guilty as charged of obstruction of prosecution and abuse of a corpse. Stuart Bagley said his family felt relief after Thursday's roller coaster of emotions as jury deliberations seemed to be deadlocked. "We felt defeated," said the father, standing outside the Linn County Courthouse. We didn't want to do this all over again. It's too much. The judge did the right thing to make the jurors keep going to reach a verdict. About an hour after they started Thursday morning, jurors sent a note to 6th District Judge Christopher Bruns saying they were deadlocked because one juror wasn't following the court's instructions and the law. They said they took a vote and it was 11-1. They initially said further deliberations wouldn't help, but Bruns, after talking with defense lawyers and prosecutors, sent a note back telling the jurors to continue deliberations to reach a unanimous verdict. The jury informed the court attendant it had a verdict after 3:30 p.m. Blahnik, who didn't show any emotion when the verdict was read, faces up to 50 years on the murder conviction and 2 years each on the other two charges. He must serve 70% of the murder sentence before being eligible for parole. There also is a federal court detainer on Blahnik, and he faces drug charges stemming from the Chris Bagley investigation. Judge Bruns set sentencing for October 12. The prosecution put on 6 days of testimony, but the defense rested without calling Blahnik or any other witnesses. Blahnik's attorney, Leon Spies, said in his closing argument to the jury earlier this week that the killing was in self-defense or in the defense of others. Blahnik's family was in the courtroom for the verdict, as they were throughout the trial. According to testimony at the trial, Blahnik hunted down Bagley, age 31, of Walker, on behalf of drug dealer Andrew Shaw, who wanted Bagley eliminated. Drew Wagner, already convicted in this case, testified he and Blahnik found Bagley in the early morning hours of December 14, 2018, at a trailer owned by Paul Hoff in Cedar Rapids. Wagner got into an argument that escalated into a shoving or wrestling match with Bagley. When Wagner had control of Bagley with his arms around him, pinning Bagley's arms down, Blahnik started stabbing him. Hoff, also charged in this case, testified Blahnik took a knife from behind his back and in a punching motion started stabbing Bagley and screaming like a maniac. A medical examination said Bagley was stabbed 13 times in the neck and torso. Most of the wounds to the stomach, spinal column, spleen, and abdomen could have been fatal, she said. Wagner also testified that Bagley had pulled drug and money robberies on Shaw, who later was convicted in federal court of being a large-scale marijuana trafficker in Cedar Rapids. Shaw told Blahnik to take care of Bagley, who was messing up, his business testimony showed. Shaw hasn't been charged in this case. He was sentenced to 8 years for drugs and firearms violation and remains in federal prison. Wagner admitted during the trial that he and Blahnik had intended to kill Bagley that day. Blahnik, in earlier statements to a grand jury, and Wagner both said Bagley had a gun during the fight, but Wagner said the gun fell to the floor during the struggle and was never a threat to him or to Blahnik. Hoff testified there was no gun. Blahnik, in his grand jury testimony played at trial, said he saw Bagley reach behind his back for the gun during the struggle, so he grabbed a knife off a counter and started stabbing Bagley to protect Wagner and himself. He said Bagley was the aggressor and he feared for his life. Hoff said all three of them helped wrap up the body in a plastic tarp and bedsheet and loaded it into Wagner's truck. Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter, during her closing argument to the jury, said Blahnik and Wagner buried Bagley's body in Wagner's yard by the garage after they left the trailer that morning. She also pointed out the entire killing incident took only 12 minutes, based on the surveillance video of when Blahnik and Wagner arrived at Hoff's trailer and left with Bagley's body in the bed of the pickup truck. The body was found buried under a pile of lumber and a canoe by the Wagner's garage. Law enforcement had to warm the frozen ground February 28, 2019, before they could dig through the snow and ice to recover the body. Spies, during his closing, questioned the credibility and motivations of Wagner, who received a plea deal, and of Hoff, who is serving 14 years on federal charges of drugs and firearms, and who wanted a lesser sentence in exchange for his testimony and cooperation in this case. Spies argued Blahnik, a former Army Ranger, intervened when he saw Bagley's gun to protect Wagner and himself. Quote, "This is one soldier defending him, another and himself," end quote, he said. Also on the front page, Ragbri rolls into town. This accompanied by a photo of several bicyclists crossing an intersection and the story by Riley Wilson. From Anamosa, even after enduring 5 days of scorching heat and hundreds of miles of pedaling, Ragbri cyclists were in high spirits Thursday as they rode into town after the longest day on this year's route to spend the night. Thursday's 84.7-mile trek, the lengthiest of the Ragbri's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, took cyclists from Waterloo to Anamosa with a meeting stop in Center Point. Riders next head 64 miles to DeWitt. The 7-day ride across the state is back after a 1-year hiatus due to the pandemic, and seasoned veterans and first-time riders alike were out in force. An estimated 15,000 cyclists were participating in this year's ride, which ends Saturday in Clinton. Riders looking to add an extra challenge to the day Thursday took the optional Karas Loop, named after one of the ride's founders, John Karas, a loop that brought the day's mileage to over 100. As riders began to arrive in Anamosa in the afternoon, sweat and exhaustion did not deter a festive atmosphere with cyclists and visitors taking in musical performances, food vendors, and many places to enjoy a cold beer. The centerpiece of Anamosa's Ragbri plans for greeting riders is the 25-foot-tall God Bless America statue, a giant work inspired by the figures in Grant Wood's American Gothic. The town hopes to keep the statue, valued at $880,000, permanently. A sign next to the statue encouraged riders and onlookers to make a donation. Jan Neerling of Mason City says she has participated 20 times in the annual bike ride. She was walking in town with her bike wearing a colorful tutu she made herself. Neerling, age 63, said she keeps coming back because of the people she meets along the route and because the training needed to complete the ride keeps her in shape. "Beats getting old," she said. Before the day's ride ended in Anamosa, cyclists arrived around mid-morning in Center Point, the Linn County town serving as the meeting town for the day. Center Point's stop was pig-themed, derived from the town's annual Pork Day celebration. For Center Point Urbana High School students, the event was a chance to raise funds for their prom. Students donned sparkly prom dresses, and one even dressed in a giant pig suit for cyclists to take photos with. Cole Werner, age 16, said the stunt raised at least $80 for the post-prom event. He sported a rhinestone-studded purple prom dress over his t-shirt, taking pictures with riders. "I was a little shy at first, but you get used to it," he said. While most choose to complete the ride on bicycles, a few have found alternate modes of transportation. Arnav Shah, age 35, of New York City, is completing the entire route on his inline skates for the second time. "We're here because, one, we want to have a fun time. We love to skate," he said. "And two, we want to show what's possible on skates, that it's something very accessible to people and you can get to some pretty cool places." Shaw brought along a group of six fellow skaters who are gliding through the week without saddle sores. He was completing the Karis Loop, also known as the Century Loop, skating over 100 miles Thursday, and encouraged some of his more reluctant teammates to come along. They've gone from, "There's no way I'm doing the Century Loop," to, "I'll consider it," to, "Get in my patch," he said. That's been the progression. While the roads of Ragbri are packed with many veterans who have done the ride for years, some are taking their first trek across the state this year. Alex Patterson, age 31, from Ames, moved to Iowa 2 years ago and knew it was one of the things he had to check off his list while living there. He cycled 4 times a week to train, but still was in for a surprise with the terrain. "I was told Iowa was flat. I'd been lied to," he said. "I climb more today than I ever have in my life." Despite riding for the first time, he also decided to take on the challenge of the Century Loop. "Look, I'm here. I'm going to do the loop. I have to," he said. "As soon as I started climbing, I was like, this is fine. It was miserable. It was pain, but this is the ride now." Cindy Burnt of Parker, Colorado, visited Iowa for the first time for Ragbri. She had planned to come with a team, but when the group fell through, she and her husband committed to doing the ride on their own. Burnt, age 41, said the ride so far has been difficult but enjoyable. "I have not come across one person who is unhappy," she said, "and even when we're miserable in the heat, they're still happy. It is pretty cool to be around thousands of positive people all day long, even when we're all struggling." Also on the front page, pop-up pantry supply drive helps prepare students for the school year. This story by Grace King. Mount Vernon and Lisbon students are more prepared to start the school year next month after a supply drive has provided 141 kids with the items they need from their classroom-provided school supply lists. Kids who were signed up for the school supply drive received a free backpack plus all the items listed to start the 2021-22 school year. Families and community members on Wednesday also got their choice of food items they needed at a pop-up food pantry. The school supply drive and pop-up pantry were held at Mount Vernon Middle School by Food for Thought, a community group formed to address food insecurity in Mount Vernon and Lisbon. It was created at the end of January 2019 when severe cold weather forced many eastern Iowa schools to close for up to a week. "We became concerned kids were not getting regular lunch and breakfast," Mount Vernon Superintendent Greg Battenhorst said. Community members put together a food pantry within 24 hours for the great need at the time. Since then, Food for Thought has organized about 7 pop-up food pantries. Wednesday's was the first of 2021. Battenhorst said there wasn't a huge need earlier for a food pantry to benefit school children, since free breakfast and lunch has been available to kids since the pandemic began in Iowa in March 2020 through the Federal Summer Food Service Program. When the pandemic started, the Mount Vernon District Food Service staff served lunch at Davis Park in Mount Vernon in good and bad weather from March to the end of May 2020. After over a year of serving free breakfast and lunch during the summer and throughout the school year, Mount Vernon ended summer lunches June 30. "I needed to give my food service staff some time off," Battenhorst said. Battenhorst noted many families now are receiving pandemic electronic benefit transfer benefits, or PEBT, to help them put food on the table. "We're listening to our community to know what they need when they need it," he said. Nicole McAlexander, executive director at Southeast Lynn Community Center, has seen the benefits of partnering with Food for Thought in the community. The Southeast Lynn Community Center serves children, seniors, and low-income individuals in Mount Vernon and Lisbon. "We've been fighting hunger in the community for 35 years," she said. Food for Thought raised awareness of food insecurity and got new volunteers involved in the organization. Over 40 new households have connected with the community center through Food for Thought, McAlexander said. "It helped us connect with people who qualify for our pantry but weren't using it." The school supply drive was organized by the Southeast Lynn Community Center. McAlexander said the cost of school supplies is funded from the center's budget and donations from community members and churches. "Some kids are definitely not ready in July to start thinking about going back to school," McAlexander said. "The younger ones get excited and there's joy on their faces. It's never easy for families to have to ask for help like this," Kate Rose, a volunteer and co-founder of Food for Thought, said. "There is always an impressive amount of food donated for Food for Thought pop-up pantries. People are able to shop for what they need from tables filled with items like peanut butter, spaghetti and sauce, meat, and other food items. Each pop-up pantry serves an average of 50 households. The need increased exponentially during the pandemic," Rose said. "People lost their jobs. Children were home more and not in school. There's a need, and it's one of the things many of us have had the opportunity to realize as a result of the pandemic." "Children shouldn't start their day hungry," she continued. "How can you possibly be hungry and concentrate on a lesson when all you're thinking about is, wouldn't breakfast be great?" There is not a date set yet for the next Food for Thought pop-up pantry, but it will be advertised through the school districts, Southeast Lynn Community Center, and flyers placed around town, McAlexander said. The pop-up pantries are open to anyone facing food insecurity in Mount Vernon and Lisbon. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, police charge a Cedar Rapids man in a pedestrian mall shooting. This story by John Steppe. Iowa City Police charged Andre Roberts, Jr., age 19, of Cedar Rapids, after police said he fired several shots early Sunday on the Iowa City pedestrian mall. He was charged with attempted murder, use of a dangerous weapon in the commission of a crime, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, and carrying dangerous weapons while being ineligible to do so. Police said the shooter fired several shots in an alley behind the Fieldhouse Bar at about 1:10 a.m., striking a 24-year-old woman and 17-year-old man. Both sustained non-life-threatening injuries, according to the police. The shooting occurred hours after the Iowa City downtown block party concluded. Police said the investigation into the shooting continues as they search for others involved. Also on the Today page, Willis Adady raises $3.2 million to build workspace and housing for homeless in Cedar Rapids. This story by Marissa Payne. Last summer's derecho wreaked havoc on Willis Adady Homeless Services' initial plans for a new workforce hub and supportive housing unit for clients. But after months of working to chart a path forward, officials Thursday shared their vision to break the cycle of homelessness. The agency has raised about $3.25 million for its $3.42 million Willis Adady Works project, which will renovate two old buildings at a central location off First Avenue Northwest to provide an employment hub and supportive housing for clients. Officials say the mission behind this project is to empower people experiencing homelessness to become self-sufficient through short-term work and affordable rental housing. For an individual experiencing homelessness, just an opportunity for them to lift themselves out of that situation and gain the skills necessary to succeed on their own is incredibly important. And that's where we really look at giving someone a hand up, Willis Adady Development Director Emily Zimmon said. The employment hub at the old McClanahan building, 800 First Avenue Northwest, will provide workforce training, one-on-one case management, direct employment, and a social enterprise warehouse to help those experiencing or at risk of homelessness. Existing staff will relocate there, and new staff will be added when employment grows. Fewer than 40% of real estate clients are employed when they enter services, according to the agency, as they face barriers to regularly attending work, ranging from lack of transportation to housing or family crises. The old Chandler Pump Company building at 707 B Avenue Northwest will be reconstructed into 13 apartments to provide a safe space for individuals and families leaving homelessness. These supportive housing units serve those with multiple barriers, typically both a physical and mental illness or disability, previous or current substance abuse disorder, and a breakdown of support systems such as friends and family. All tenants pay monthly rent, which is capped at 30% of their income, and work with a Willis Dady case manager the whole time they are in the program. The case manager will be a full-time employee who works and lives on-site in one of the units. Willis Dady Executive Director Alicia Faust said from 2017 to 2019, 81 families in Cedar Rapids were flagged as being in need of long-term supportive housing. Both buildings sustained damage in the derecho's hurricane-force winds last summer, upending original plans for the project. Cedar Rapids City Council member Scott Olson, the project coordinator for Willis Dady Works, said the workforce space was planned to go on the first floor of the Chandler Pump building, and housing units would have occupied the second floor. But the derecho destroyed the facility's top floor. Now, Olson said, the employment hub space is expected to be ready to use within 2 to 3 months. The housing units in the Chandler Pump building should be ready no later than early 2022. Project funders continued to support the project, and the historic site remained eligible for tax credits, Olson said. Turning now to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial is titled, Iowa Slipping Back on COVID. Iowa made great strides for more than half a year at driving down the rate of COVID-19 infection. That progress is in jeopardy as coronavirus figures have started to tick back up in the past several weeks. Luckily, there is already a solution available to us. We know the vaccines are effective at reducing transmission and especially effective at reducing severe illness from COVID-19. We also know, however, that children under 12 are not cleared to receive the vaccines. It's also possible that the vaccine's efficacy wanes over time and that they might not be less, or that they might not be less effective against new variants. Those facts underscore the need for people who are eligible to get vaccinated as soon as possible. There's never a good time for a surge in virus activity, but this one coincides with Iowa's busy summer travel and event season. People taking trips without or outside the state risk spreading the virus or bringing it home with them. Thousands of people are gathering at the Rag Bryan County Fairs across the state, and the Iowa State Fair is scheduled to start next month. It could be a recipe for disaster. The increase in cases also comes after Iowa lowered basically all of the state's defenses against coronavirus. The limited mask requirement imposed by Governor Kim Reynolds last year was rescinded in February. What's more, due to a law signed by the governor this spring, schools this coming academic year will be prohibited from requiring students to wear masks. The Test Iowa program that conducted more than 500,000 coronavirus tests at drive-in locations ended this month in favor of a system of take-home tests. Also, the state recently stopped providing daily case numbers and now is only disclosing that data to the public once a week. Insufficient as those safeguards may have been, they at least gave us timely information about the virus's spread. Now we're flying blind as the disease shows signs of a deadly resurgence. No one is eager to return to last year's norm of wearing masks, staying home, and socially distancing, least of all the governor. To avoid a situation like that, it's imperative that vaccine holdouts take the shot. And again, that is the Gazette's own editorial. And in a guest column today, downtown Cedar Rapids is bouncing back, this by Jesse Thomig. This summer, the downtown Cedar Rapids SSMID, or Self-Supported Municipality District, unveiled a new brand and logo for the district. Meant to distinguish our downtown and embrace the river that runs through it, the unveiling coincided with the successful return of the downtown farmers market on June 19. This new look for downtown is the culmination of much effort on the part of the SSMID Commission, staff at the Economic Alliance, and local marketing firm and several downtown stakeholders and volunteers. For nearly 15 months, downtown Cedar Rapids, like just about every other city center or district around the globe, saw throngs of people who compromised their Monday to Friday workforce move to the work-from-home model to repel and stay safe from the coronavirus pandemic. Here locally, nearly 15,000 people who worked in and around downtown prior to the outbreak dwindled to less than 3,000 from March 2020 until late spring this year. An 80% drop in day-to-day foot traffic for our locally owned shops, restaurants, and bars was a most difficult hand to play. However, at long last, there is definitive hope on the horizon with more people returning to downtown every day. Downtowns and other core districts are essential for communities as they strive to grow and thrive. They remind us of our heritage and where we have been, but they also provide a window to the future and where we're going. And they are for everyone. The city of Cedar Rapids has done tremendous work in recent years, improving the overall walkability and connectivity of our downtown. It's been proven time and again that places with improved scores in these two regards lead directly to healthier communities and ones with higher household incomes per capita. Leaders and staff at City Hall are also working tirelessly to support private developers who are trying to bring transformative projects to the core of our city, like re-engineering the 5-in-1 dam to allow for recreational use, a dual hotel and rooftop bar at 3rd and 3rd, and an essential multi-use development at 1st and 1st West. This new look for the downtown district is in no way transformative, but we do hope that it marks the time in which our community and its core began to bounce back from another natural disaster, this one being a crisis that impacted our entire planet. I had lived in Cedar Rapids for 3 years when the cataclysmic flood of 2008 hit. I witnessed firsthand the strength and resiliency of the city and its residents. I have every expectation that our local comeback story will mirror the success that occurred here over a decade ago. There is plenty of reason to be hopeful and excited. We believe locals and visitors alike will see the improvements and added vibrancy to our downtown. It was the ultimate shot in the arm to see nearly 13,000 people flood the streets at the first 3 farmers markets of the new season. Hopefully, in the not too distant future, we will look back at that time as a harbinger for the progress and the good to come. And that is submitted by Jesse Thoming, who is Executive Director of the Cedar Rapids Downtown District. 2 community letters on the Insight page today. First, this one titled Frustrated at Outsourced Printing by the Gazette. After reading the community letters in a recent Gazette, I felt compelled to add my thoughts to the growing list of disgruntled longtime readers. The latest snafu to outsource printing of the paper clear to Des Moines is beyond belief. Do you think adding road time to getting the paper to Cedar Rapids for distribution will mean reasonable delivery time? We battle getting the paper delivered many times for the simplest weather conditions. That has been a problem for several winters. The latest writer, Thoughts on Changes to the Gazette, July 26, referred to issues with porch delivery. For the elderly, that can be a real threat to safety. The Gazette needs to remember that many of their subscribers are middle-aged to elderly. If a poll were to be taken, I would bet most of the younger adults do not subscribe because they don't even like to watch the news on TV. Some comments as reasons are, the news is too biased, too many commercials, we're too busy. Therefore, trying to go digital as the answer may only be the demise. Maybe a solution would be to keep printing local. Don't depend heavily on advertising to stay afloat. Keep subscription rates affordable so people can justify subscribing and get more area community news included rather than just Iowa City. A newspaper has been vital to communities all through history. Do it right, and hopefully others can learn from it. And that's signed by Susan Oler of Springville. And our second letter, unvaccinated Iowans unlikely to heed the state's calls. Those of us concerned over the recent spike in COVID-19 cases in Iowa can take some comfort from the words of state epidemiologist and medical director Dr. Caitlin Pedatti. Iowa's state epidemiologist, COVID-19 vaccine, most important thing you can talk about, Iowa Watch. Unfortunately, her words fall on deaf ears in the governor's office and state legislature. Catering to her anti-mask supporters, the governor proudly signed a bill banning face mandates in schools while later posing with a woman with a sign indicating masks cause staph infections. Apparently, she's more concerned about upsetting her anti-mask base and jeopardizing her future in national politics than she is about protecting the lives of Iowans. That letter signed by David Sherwood of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Friday, July 30, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. And in one short notice from Marion, Marlene R. Eichhorn, age 88, died Thursday, July 29. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. On to the regular notices. First from Anamosa, Edward Oltmans, age 71, died Tuesday, July 27 at Unity Point Jones Regional Medical Center. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, August 4 at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran Church in rural Monticello. Pastor Holly Knaus will officiate. Burial will be in Prairie Hill Cemetery. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 3 at Getch Funeral Home, Anamosa. Please visit GetchOnline.com to share your stories, memories, thoughts, and condolences. From Iowa City, Larry C. Bruce, age 83, longtime associate of the University of Iowa Foundation, died Saturday, July 24. Arrangements are pending at this time through Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. From Quasquetan, Franklin Dean Deemer, age 76, of Quasquetan, died Thursday, July 29, at the ABCM Rehabilitation Center, East Campus, in Independence, Iowa. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday at the Reef Family Center, Independence, where friends may call from 1:30 p.m. to service time. Interment services to be held Monday at Rose Hill Cemetery in Mount Air. To leave an online condolence, please go to thereeffamilycenter.com under obituaries. From Cedar Rapids, F. James, known as Jim Bradley, shared his last embraces with family on Wednesday, July 28, 2021. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Monday, August 2nd at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral Mass is at 10 a.m. Tuesday, August 3 at All Saints Catholic Church. For those who are not vaccinated or are otherwise unable to personally attend, please see Cedar Memorial website for streaming information. Memorial contribution suggestion is Mount Mercy University Bradley Family Scholarship or Cedar Rapids Community Health Free Clinic. Online condolences can be left at cedarmemorial.com. From Cedar Rapids, Betty Knupp, age 96, passed away July 25 at the Woodlands in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 7 at the United Methodist Church, 517 2nd Street, Columbus Junction. The Reverend Melanie Greengo and the Reverend Kay Minnick will co-officiate at the service. Food and fellowship will follow the service at the same location in the Fellowship Hall. For a full obituary, please visit www.iowacremation.com. From Cedar Rapids, Donald Robert Conway, age 94, originally of Stumptown in Cedar Rapids, died peacefully Tuesday, July 27, at the Hiawatha Care Center. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Monday, August 2, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church, 1224 5th Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids, by the Reverend Dennis Conway. Burial at St. John's Cemetery with military rites by the Cedar Valley Detachment 099 of the Marine Corps League and VFW Post 788, where he was a life member. Visitation is from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, August 1, at the Papich Kuba Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast, where a time of Marine Corps and VFW remembrances will begin at 3:30 p.m. From Iowa City, Kenneth, known as Kenny Allen Funk, age 67, died Tuesday, July 27, at Mercy Hospital following a sudden illness. Funeral services will be at 9:30 a.m. Monday, August 2, at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. Visitation will be Sunday from 2 to 5 at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memory Garden Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Kenny Funk Memorial Fund. From North Liberty, Gwen J. Wren Hesser passed away at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics on Wednesday, July 28, surrounded by loving family. A visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 1, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A memorial service will be held 1 p.m. Monday, August 2, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, with the certified celebrant Jim Parton officiating. A live stream of the service will be available under the obituary for Gwen Hesser, starting at 1 p.m. on Monday, August 2. And in the final obituary, Josephine, known as Joe Elizabeth Littrell or Luttrell from Williamsburg, died Wednesday, July 28 at the Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg at the age of 85. Celebration of life service will be held 2 p.m. Monday, August 2 at the St. Paul United Methodist Church in Williamsburg. Pastor John Christensen will officiate. Visitation will be on Monday from noon until service time at the church. Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 10, at Carmen Cemetery in Carmen, Oklahoma. Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is caring for services, messages, and tributes may be directed at www.powellfuneralhomes.com. Moving over to the sports page, State Baseball Class 1A, St. Albert holds off Key for the title, this story by K.J. Pilcher. The grit and toughness was there for Lansing Key. Unfortunately, they didn't produce the same result as the previous two games. The fourth-seeded Hawks battled back from a six-run deficit to challenge number two-seed Council Bluffs St. Albert, but fell short in a 7-5 loss in the Class 1A State Baseball Championship game Thursday at Merchants Park. "Our guys kept fighting," Key coach Jim Moss said. "We scored four in the sixth inning to make it a game. We had two guys on. We were right there, and that's just the heart of our team. It's not always pretty, but they just never quit, and I can't be more proud of that team." Key earned its state-best 17th summer state championship game. It is the eighth runner-up finish in school history. The Hawks aren't satisfied and already have sights set on next season. "We have a chip on our shoulder now," Tyson Cota said. "You can expect us back next year fighting for a championship." St. Albert took control early with two runs in each of the first three innings and another in the fourth. Kai Patterson smacked a two-run double in the first, an error, and Jeff Miller's RBI single resulted in two in the second, and Dan McGrath blooped a two-run single in the third for the Falcons. Key's, "It's not always pretty, but they just never quit." Keys only won through five. The Hawks stranded eight runners through four and 10 total. Offensively, they're really good, and they're clicking, Moss said. They haven't given up a lot of runs either. We put some things together, but they're clicking. They have some nice pieces, and they do a nice job with their program. St. Albert coach Duncan Patterson watched the Hawks overcome a slim deficit in the quarterfinals and come back to down top-seeded Rims and St. Mary's in extra innings. He wasn't taking the lead for granted. I expected them to make it a game, Patterson said. They're scrappy. This is a heck of a team. It's never over until you get that last out, and they proved that all weekend. Key demonstrated its fight with a four-run sixth. The Hawks nearly battled through its order. Cam Lind started things with a single, and Braden Mathis was hit by a pitch and following at bat. The threat ended with the third out on the base paths and go-ahead run at the plate. We're not going to give up or hang our heads, Cota said. If we're down four runs or 20 runs, we're going to fight back. We're in the state championship game. You have to have fun and try our best. Cota pitched a complete game for Key. He remained strong throughout, leaving the bases loaded in the fifth and holding a runner at third in the sixth to keep the Hawks within striking distance. In the seventh, Reinke reached on an error with one out, but Cy Patterson produced a strikeout and flyout to end it. And in Class 4A, coming back again, this story by Jeff Johnson, it was a replay, only with a later and bigger ending. A six-run top of the seventh inning rallied Cedar Rapids Prairie's baseball team past West Des Moines Dowling 8-4 on Thursday afternoon at Banks Field in the Class 4A state tournament quarterfinal. Those Hawks have some sort of flair for the dramatic, obviously. They came from behind in the sixth inning of their sub-state final last week to beat Cedar Falls. On the biggest stage, in their very next game, they upped the ante. Maybe score six runs in the first inning next time, boys. That's what we're trying to do, said Prairie outfielder Colton Forsland with a smile, but we always like to scare coach a little bit. Prairie, at 33-8, plays top-ranked and top-seeded Pleasant Valley, 35-4, in a 5 p.m. semifinal today. PV won a regular season game between the teams, 4-3. The guys' energy was good. They stuck with it. They're confident in that situation, Prairie coach James Nelson said. The message really doesn't change much for us. We feel like all the time, no matter who's leading off, no matter what the situation is, that now is a great time. Now is a great time. We were like, hey, enjoy the moment. This is a great moment. Go make something happen. And we did. Dowling, at 32-8, took advantage of some sloppy Prairie defensive play in the fourth to score three runs and assume a 4-2 lead. That's the way the game stayed until the seventh. Caden Richards led off the seventh with a walk, then pinch hitter Aiden Moeller singled through the left side. It was just his second hit of the season in just his 11th at bat. The wild pitch moved guys up a base, and leadoff hitter Bronx Lewis singled up the middle to tie the game, going to second on the throw to the plate. A hit by pitch and line out to right was followed by a Brandon Vicko infield single that loaded the bases with one out. Nate Kuiper singled up the middle to score two and put Prairie on top 6-4. Again, the runners moved up a bag on the throw home, scoring when Forsland chopped a single over a drawn-in Dowling shortstop. The comeback was complete. We're always confident in that situation. Know if we start with one guy, it's just going to keep on a roll, Forsland said. That's exactly what happened. Once we got the first guy on and we got a pinch hitter get a hit, we were confident, because Bronx was coming up. Pitcher Jackson Nove worked around a one-out walk in the bottom of the seventh, and that was that. Nove headed to the University of Kentucky through a complete game in his final high school start, allowing six hits and four walks, striking out four. He retired 11 of the final 12 hitters he faced. I felt all right, he said. I didn't feel like I had my best outing by far. I threw well enough to keep my team in it, give them an opportunity to win. Prairie was able to get freshman Dowling ace Blake Larson out of the game after five innings, which was humongous. Already a TCU commit, the lefty showed off a 90-mile-an-hour fastball here, striking out seven and giving up three hits, including Cal Sullivan's opposite field two-run home run. Class 3A and 4A state tournament play continues today at Banks Field in Iowa City. And on the radio, you can listen to the Cubs at the Nationals at 6 p.m. The Twins are at the Cardinals at 6:30 p.m. Moving to the Business 380 page, this AP story, hog dealer fires workers after USDA levies fines. An influential hog dealer sanctioned twice for defrauding pork producers out of hundreds of thousands of dollars says it has fired employees responsible for its latest violations and paid restitutions to affected sellers. Lynch Livestock, based in Wacoma, also announced that pork industry veteran Dan Sutherland would lead the company going forward as a further safeguard against future violations, citing Sutherland's experience in compliance matters. Lynch announced these moves in a news release posted online Wednesday after the AP reported the U.S. Department of Agriculture had taken enforcement action against the company for illegal buying practices for the second time since 2017. The company's longtime owner, Gary Lynch, a political donor to Iowa Republican officials, hasn't returned messages seeking comment. In the release, his company said the USDA received a complaint in January that employees at its Wacoma buying station were manipulating the scale and issuing false tickets to artificially lower payments to producers. Lynch said it investigated the allegations and terminated an unspecified number of employees who engaged in those practices. Although this situation arose due to the actions of a few employees at one buying station, we take this matter very seriously, Gary Lynch was quoted as saying. We have already made great strides in establishing new processes and procedures to empower employees and ensure producers receive fair compensation. USDA said its investigation found the practices went on for 3 years, from January 2018 through 2020. The agency ordered Lynch Livestock to pay $445,626 in penalties and restitution and to stop recording false weights, altering classifications of hog deliveries, and creating false scale tickets. The company said restitution has already been sent to producers who were underpaid for their hogs. The USDA had ordered Lynch to pay a fine and restitution and to stop the same practices in 2017 after an investigation found the company willfully violated the Packers and Stockyards Act. Company employees arbitrarily lowered weights for delivered hogs, downgraded their classifications, fictitiously claimed dead hogs to lower prices, and created false scale tickets to back up altered weights. Also on the Business 380 page, an interesting article from the Minneapolis Star Tribune by Steve Alexander with answers to a question, cheapest way to build a home music library. Question, I'm interested in downloading about 200 songs from the internet and eventually putting them on a USB drive. What's the cheapest way to do that? Answer, the cheapest method is to purchase the songs rather than to subscribe to an online streaming music service, even though the upfront cash outlay will be greater. Purchasing songs typically costs $1.29 each from the larger providers such as Apple or Amazon, though both sell some songs for less. If you multiply $1.29 by 200 songs, your one-time cost would be $258. A music subscription from Apple or Amazon costs $120 a year. Once you've purchased songs, adding them to a flash drive is no problem because the DRM, or Digital Rights Management, software that formerly restricted song copying is largely a thing of the past. Most songs are sold today in the universal MP3 format that is compatible with nearly any music playing device. Apple sells songs in the AAC format, but the iTunes or music programs can convert the songs to MP3 format. iTunes songs downloaded before 2009 are protected by DRM. Use DRM removal software to convert them to MP3s. And in another question, I'm trying to connect a Canon Pixma printer to a Google Chromebook. The Chromebook seems to recognize the printer, but nothing happens. What's wrong? Your printer is compatible with your Chromebook. The problem may be you're trying to print via the Google Cloud Print service that was discontinued in January. Cloud Print used your Google account to upload a print job to an online server, which sent it back to your printer. In the absence of Cloud Print, you can connect the Chromebook to the printer through your home Wi-Fi network. Turning now to the living section, an article by Barbara Quinn for the Monterey, California Herald, "Be Careful with Supplements and Blood Thinners." Question: I read your column on vitamin K. I'm a 75-year-old woman who takes warfarin daily because of an arterial clot. I've been told not to take vitamin K. Here's my question. Can I take vitamin K2 for bone health and not worry about having an adverse impact on my INR or causing clotting? Thanks for your response. And the answer. First, I would follow your medical provider's orders. They know your complete medical condition better than I. That said, here's more information on vitamin K2, also known as monoquinone, MK. As I mentioned in the previous column, vitamin K is necessary to help your blood clot normally, which comes in handy when we're injured to prevent us from bleeding to death. Warfarin has the opposite effect on blood clotting. It helps thin the blood to prevent dangerous blood clots due to certain medical conditions. Here's the catch. Vitamin K is an essential nutrient that our bodies require for normal functioning. In other words, we need a certain amount of vitamin K, which includes K1 as well as K2. The current adequate intake set by the Institute of Medicine is 90 micrograms a day for women and 120 for men. Earlier this year, a study in healthy volunteers, people not taking warfarin or blood thinners, found that vitamin K2 supplementation did not interfere with normal blood clotting mechanisms. However, it's a different story for those who take a medication like warfarin to prevent blood clots. Experts caution you not to take extra doses of vitamin K from supplements because sudden changes in vitamin K intakes can interfere with how this medicine works. So, if you're on blood thinners, it's best to avoid all forms of vitamin K supplements, including vitamin K2. Even low doses have been found to significantly affect the actions of anticoagulant medications. All is not lost, however. Remember that vitamin K2 is synthesized in our guts by the good bacteria Lactobacillus. Include fermented dairy foods like yogurt in your diet, along with food high in dietary fiber, like fruit, vegetables, and whole grains to feed these good gut bugs. Vitamin K2 is also found in cheese, egg yolk, and meat. A 1-ounce slice of Munster cheese contains about 22 micrograms, and a 3.5-ounce serving of chicken contains 10 micrograms of vitamin K2. Interestingly, animal-based foods are better sources of vitamin K2, while plant foods such as green leafy vegetables are higher in K1. Best advice, follow your doctor's orders and avoid vitamin K2 supplements. And don't make sudden changes in the foods you eat without first telling your medical team. In the weather category, chance of storms today and hazy. Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 80 degrees and a low of 63, and the same for Iowa City. Our normal high today is 85, and our normal low is 64. We set the record high of 106 degrees in 1913 at a record low of 47 in 1971. Sunset tonight's at 8:27, sunrise tomorrow at 5:59 a.m., giving us 14 hours and 29 minutes of daylight. We are in the waning gibbous moon phase with moon rise at 12:06 a.m. and set at 1:54. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, July 30. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.